Well, I don't know about you, but when I was a little kid, I had all kinds of fantasies about things. If I had lived back in the time of Christ or lived back in the time of Moses, surely how much greater faith and opportunities we can have. But remember what Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 1. In verse 10, he talks about the salvation that the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come, that they were privileged with giving those prophecies, but they made careful searches and inquiries, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you and these things which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. So, I mean, what Peter basically says is the prophets themselves didn't fully understand everything that they were, trying to accomplish. We'll get that taken sorted out one way or the other. And the angels themselves don't understand fully everything that's going on. So just the fact if we had lived at a certain time or place that we would know all of what God was up to is not necessarily the case. And so sometimes we might say, if I could have just been an apostle, or if I could have been a prophet or something like that. But I think we ought to pause at least and ask ourselves, we really, want to be a prophet? What would be involved in being a prophet? And there were often high prices to be paid for being a prophet. We've seen that in the case of Ezekiel and some of the bizarre things that God had Ezekiel do. And Ezekiel's not the only one. Jeremiah had some bizarre things God asked him to do. Isaiah had some odd things God had asked him to do. But there are some occasions in which God even intrudes into the very personal and private lives of the prophets. And there are four of these in particular that come to mind. There's Isaiah, in which God tells Isaiah, this is what you're going to name your kid. He has one son we know of who has the name She'er Yashuv, or a remnant will return. And of course, it's a symbolic name to indicate kind of two things at the same time, that there's judgment of God coming against the people, and therefore there's only going to be a remnant. But there is hope in the future because the remnant will come back. But there's another child that he has in chapter 8 of Isaiah and verse 3. And there, God tells Isaiah, you're going to name him Bahar Shalal Hashbaz. That probably doesn't sound as bizarre to them in Hebrew as it does to us as a name. But it's another symbolic name. The spoil of war is hurling along rapidly because judgment was coming very quickly. I don't know how much it would bother me that God would come along and say, now I know you've got a name picked out for your kid. You really are impartial to, Michael or Bob or whatever. But no, you're going to name this child this. But at least it's understandable. Okay, it's going to be a symbolic of something. Maybe we can give him a nickname anyway. But then you come to Jeremiah. And you know what God asked of Jeremiah? Very personally, very privately, he told Jeremiah, do not get married in Jeremiah chapter 16. Not just don't get married, but don't have a family either. That was one of the consequences of this, a prohibition against marriage. And again, it's a symbolic action. The children that are being born to the parents of that age were going to die. They were going to be killed in judgment. People would lose their spouses as well, things like that. And that seems a little bit more intrusive than just, here's the name you're going to give to your kid. But then again, is it really that bad? That's kind of a judgment call. But then we come to Hosea, of course, and Hosea is told to get married, but then he's told actually to marry a certain kind of person, to marry a woman of harlotry or a whore. Someone who is guilty of sexual immorality. And he does. And he has several children by this woman. And it's intriguing that we're not told explicitly the children really do belong to him. And even in the third chapter of Hosea, verse 1, the Lord says to him, go again, show your love to this woman, even though she loves another, even committing adultery, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love to offer raisin cakes to these idols. Well, that seems pretty intrusive. God telling you you've got to get married, but you're going to have to marry a wrong kind of person, and the painful kind of experience that's going to mean for Hosea. But perhaps the most intrusive of all is that of Ezekiel. And since we've been studying Ezekiel, I thought, well, we might touch upon this. We're not really going to be looking at resuming our study in Ezekiel here, but God takes Ezekiel's wife from him. She dies. And now whether she was just going to die anyway, she had some terminal cancers, we don't know. The timing seems pretty exact when God takes his wife away from him. And the odd thing here is he tells Ezekiel not to grieve. Now, he can grieve a little bit, so to speak, but not really outwardly making a show of his grief. And so, if you will, turn to Ezekiel chapter 24, and we'll kind of look at this and see what we might make of that. It certainly seems to be the highest price that Ezekiel pays for being a prophet, that he will lose his wife. And again, it just makes you ponder, think, well, what's God up to? And is that fair? What would I do if the Lord demanded something like that of me? So beginning in verse 15 of Ezekiel 24, the word of the Lord came to me saying, "Son of man, behold, I am about to take from you the desire of your eyes with a blow. You will not mourn, you will not weep, your tears shall not come. Groan and bewail the dead, make no mourning for the dead. Bind on your turban, put on your shoes on your feet, do not cover your mustache or set or eat the bread of men." And so I spoke to the people in the morning, as my wife having died the previous evening. In the morning I did as I was commanded. And the people said to me, "Will you not tell us what these things that you're doing mean for us?" And I said to them, "The word of the Lord came to me saying, 'Speak to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am about to profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the desire of your eyes, the delight of your soul, and your sons and your daughters whom you have left behind will fall by the sword. You will do as I have done. You will not cover your mustache. You will not eat the bread of men. Your turbans will be on your heads, your shoes on your feet. You will not mourn. You will not weep. But you will rot away in your iniquities, and you will groan to one another. Thus Ezekiel will be a sign to you. According to all that he has done, you will do. When it comes, then you will know that I am the Lord God.'" Well, you can see again, this is a symbolic action that God is having Ezekiel respond to the death of his wife in a certain way to foreshadow what's going to happen to the people of Israel. He says, "I'm a sign, and what I have done, you are going to do." And so there will not be this grief. There will not be this outpouring of weeping and wailing when the city of Jerusalem falls, when the temple is destroyed, when the delight of their eyes is taken away from them, just as the delight of Ezekiel's eyes have been taken away from him. Well, this, again, is probably the most intrusive that God gets into anybody's personal life, to take their spouse away from them like this. Certainly on other occasions, the prophets had to give up their lives. They were executed because their message didn't fit with the message that those in power wanted to hear. And whether you think it's worse to lose your life or lose your wife, again, that's kind of a matter of debate. I guess it might matter who you're married to, how you might assess a thing like that. But let's think about this idea of this divine intrusion. And really the question here is not whether you want to be a prophet or an apostle or something like that, but do you want to be God? Do we really want to put ourselves in the shoes of God, so to speak, and pass judgment on him or decide how he ought to do things, that this isn't right, what he is doing? And I would have us think of at least three different questions that we should consider in this regard. The first of which is God really sovereign? And if the answer to that question is yes, then we shouldn't act as if that God is just doing something completely out of bounds to take somebody's life, to withhold life from them if he were to so choose. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul says something that addresses this question even more specifically. I mean, the Bible certainly talks a great deal about the sovereignty of God and all that he has created, to whom we are accountable, and so on. And just on that basis, we ought to have some recognition that the breath of air that I breathe, the beating of my heart, the food that I eat, everything is a free gift from God, and it comes without strings attached, without obligation on his part to us. And we simply need to be grateful. And if God chooses to give me another day, I should be grateful. And if God chooses not to, I'm not entitled to that. I can't act as if I'm entitled to that. And, he again is sovereign. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul here is arguing that by virtue of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and by that he means the actual literal physical bodily resurrection of the dead body of Jesus, he says, by the same token, God has put a claim on our bodies, and we will be resurrected as well. And his conclusion in verses 19 and 20, do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you're not your own? For you've been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. Well, your body is not your own. And to put it in the terms of Ezekiel, Ezekiel's wife wasn't really his wife, as if he possessed ownership of her, and whatever happened to her was for him to choose, him to make decisions about. It belongs to God. And so, in the same way, God has his sovereignty manifest in us in the way we use our literal bodies in service to him or not. Do we really believe God is sovereign? And so what would it mean if today I were to lose my life? Just in the ordinary course of things, not necessarily having to be persecuted, go to some foreign nation and be put to death because of my faith, but just to die. Die in what may appear to be just a random, senseless car accident. But is God sovereign? And all things work out according to his purpose. That's his business. And it's not for me to be God and decide who's going to live and who's going to die, including myself or my wife or my children or anyone else. The second thing we need to think about is, does God act true to his nature? Does God act true to his nature or not? Do we have the confidence God acts consistent with his nature? You know, God is powerful. Yes. Does he act consistent with that power? Is God wise? Does he act consistent with that wisdom? Is God loving? And does God act consistently with that love? And the answer to all of those things is yes. And you remember John says twice in 1 John chapter 4, God is love. Not that God possesses love, not that God loves some people, but that God himself is the very embodiment of what love is. And love, as its most fundamental, is this unconditional, you know, not being selective, not discriminating, not saying, well, you're worthy of love, or you're going to be the object of my love, and I choose not to make another an object of my love. God is love. And that God acts in his love, even in regard to some of these things. And so, you know, does God act true to his nature in being a loving person? Well, he does. If you turn back to John chapter 11, we see a good example of this. John chapter 11. You know, this is the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead. And Martha and Mary, Lazarus' sister, send word to Jesus that Lazarus is sick. Presumably, I just want to let him know about that. He's probably seriously sick. And whether they ask this explicitly or not, maybe by implication, if he's not too busy or if he were willing or something, would he be able to come and heal Lazarus? It says, when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified by it. Okay? Now, already right there, you have to assume that this response of Jesus was given to whoever the messengers were that brought this message of Lazarus' sickness from the sisters. And presumably the messengers would have gone back and the sisters would have said, well, what did Jesus say? Oh, he said he's going to be here tomorrow and heal Lazarus. Or he can't come. Or whatever the response was. Well, presumably this is the response. This sickness is not unto death. Well, now you can see how disappointing that message might be when it turns out that Lazarus actually does die. And we know how the story is going to turn out, and it literally does not end in death, because death is not the end. Death is not the final say about Lazarus. But certainly we have to understand that that's not the clearest, most direct way Jesus could have answered their question. He could have said, well, he's going to die, but I'm going to come and resurrect him from the dead, so don't you worry about it. He could have said that, but he didn't. And instead gave a message that at best leaves it kind of misleading them to expect Lazarus is going to recover from this. I don't need to bother to come. He'll be okay. Don't worry about it. And then he winds up dying. And you think about the situation that puts the sisters in. What we thought we understood God to say, what we thought we understood Jesus to say, turns out obviously we misunderstood something. Obviously, however God meant that, it wasn't this. And then you have a choice. You can either say, well, God's an idiot. I'm not going to believe in him anymore. Or you could say, well, I need to just understand that there's some things about God I don't understand. That in humility, I simply assumed what God was saying. And now upon reflection, I realize that it could be taken in a different way, and maybe he meant something different by that. So, Jesus himself sets the stage for this kind of thinking through about what God is up to and what his purpose is. And at least, I have no way of knowing what these sisters might have thought, but at least one of the things they have to be asking themselves is Jesus acting consistent with what we know about him or who we know him to be? And they do think that way. Even when Jesus shows up, Martha and Mary don't lay into him and say, how dare you not come and heal our brother when he was sick? You know, we pleaded you, we asked for you for your help, and you just turned us down. You know, what kind of friend do you consider yourself to be? We thought you loved him. You know, oh, how much he loved you, and boy, was his love misplaced. Oh, well, I'm glad he's dead not to see this. I mean, there's all kinds of hateful things you can imagine them saying to Jesus. But they don't, because they don't lose faith in him. They still have confidence in him. Martha says, even now, whatever you ask of the Lord, I know he will grant it to you. And she's not even expecting Lazarus is going to be raised from the dead, because obviously a little bit later when Jesus goes to the tomb and says, take the stone away, Martha's response is, no, you don't want to do that. There's going to be this horrible smell. She doesn't expect resurrection. This, oh, someday the Lord will resurrect him, sure, like all of us. But of course, Jesus knows what's going to happen. God is going to be glorified through this. But now notice verse 5 and 6. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Therefore, when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now, this is critical for the telling of the story, because what it makes clear to us is everything you read about Jesus in this chapter has to be read through this filter here. Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus. And if you interpret anything that happens in this story as something inconsistent with the love of Jesus, then you don't understand the story. In fact, it is because of the love of Jesus he delayed going to Bethany and healing Lazarus. And so Lazarus is allowed to die. Now, that may seem cruel. Again, intrusive. Who is God to decide who lives and who dies? Well, he's God, first of all. But more importantly, God always acts consistent with his character. And what God was doing on this occasion was acting consistent with his love for Lazarus and Martha and Mary. Now, on one level, one could say, well, his love doesn't seem very good. It's a cruel kind of love. It's a heartless kind of love. It's a love that gave no concern for the emotions or the feelings of the family to put them through all of this. And for what? And that's where it gets into the kind of risk-benefit analysis. Was the benefit gained from this really that big of a deal? And from a worldly point of view, we say, no. What was the big deal? Well, there was a big deal because God was glorified. Jesus was glorified. And for 2,000 years, people have been talking about this story and being convicted by God's power and God's love and God's wisdom. Is that worth it? Well, God made that decision. Yes, it was. And I suspect if we asked Mary and Martha and Lazarus, they would say the same thing. But the thing we fundamentally need to understand is God did act consistent with His love. And this little story here is really an illustration of everything that God does. And so here we are in the modern age, and I have a child who gets leukemia and dies, or, you know, some other tragic thing that happens in my life, and I say, well, obviously God doesn't love me. Or if there is a God, He's not a loving God, He's not a kind God, He's not a good God. Well, is that the correct conclusion? Is that what Mary and Martha concluded? No. They continued to have faith in God, confident in God's sovereignty, and that He acted consistent with His nature. And we should have the same confidence as well. God always acts consistent with His nature. And God is a God of love. So was it unloving for Him to take Ezekiel's wife? Was it unloving of Him to ask Hosea to marry a woman like he did? Was it unloving of God to ask Jeremiah not to get married? No, it wasn't unloving. If you see the bigger picture, if you understand what's going on. And that leads us to our final question, and that is, does it do any good? Does it do me any good? Does it do others any good? And the first question, of course, is, when we think about others, does it do God any good? Well, there's no question about that. God is glorified. Now, we may have a stereotyped impression about how God should be glorified and say that, oh, well, Jesus lied about Lazarus not dying and messing around with people and their feelings, their emotions, and that's not very glorifying to God. And there are always going to be critics that will, you know, sit in their you know, armchair quarterback position and second-guess God and can say that only those things that I think glorifies God will truly glorify God. Well, God understands all of human history and knows how it's all going to work out, how all the pieces fit together. And He determines what glorifies Him, and it is all done to His glory. And Jesus made that very clear. This occasion will glorify God, and He made the best possible choice in the circumstances and was glorified through it. And we need to have confidence that God acts consistent with His nature, His power, His wisdom, and His love, all combined to glorify Himself in all things. And so if nothing else, if the only good that comes out of my misery and my suffering, my sacrifice, my loss, is God is glorified, that alone is sufficient, should be sufficient for us, because God is sovereign. God is God. But there are occasions, we know, where our loss, our suffering, our sacrifice may do others good, and so that's a concern. And we see that in the case here in Ezekiel chapter 24. And that's particularly the use that God is making of this. We've commented before that the situation of unbelief among the people of Israel at this time is pretty dire. Desperate times call for desperate measures. The prophet doing really graphic things, saying graphic things, trying to get through their thick skulls to get them to understand what's really going on. And so here is yet perhaps the most outrageous thing of all that happens, that Ezekiel's wife dies and that he is forbidden from even doing the normal kinds of things you would do to grieve the passing of a loved one. And for them, in their culture, that was pretty extreme. You know, we tend to be pretty reserved about our grief anyway. If someone came up to us and said, don't carry on about the death of a loved one, we wouldn't be really being asked to restrain ourselves that much more than we would normally. But for them, it would have been a much more graphic thing to do. And the people got that. When they saw Ezekiel acting the way he was, given the fact his wife has just died, they were like, whoa, there is something really weird going on here. And there's only a couple of occasions where the people actually come out and say, please explain to us this stuff that's going on, because we don't understand. And the one was back in chapter 12 where he dug a hole in his wall and all the other bizarre things he was doing in that chapter. And here in chapter 24 is that other occurrence in verse 19, will you not tell us what these things that you are doing mean for us? And that's a very intriguing question they ask, because it indicates that Ezekiel has been making at least some progress with these people, because they don't ask, will you explain to us what these things mean? Or what are you doing? What are you thinking? They are saying, what do these things mean for us? What are you trying to teach us? What lesson are you trying to get across to us by the way that you're acting? They had picked up enough to know that the bizarre things that Ezekiel was doing was for their benefit, was for their good. And he proceeds then to tell them the lesson. In fact, who knows, if they had not had the sense to ask, they may not have ever gotten an answer. You know, Ezekiel doesn't seem to be in the business of dispensing free advice. Matter of fact, the Lord had told him, you can only speak when I allow you to speak. And that's probably a pretty good principle right there. You know, if you go around giving out free advice, people tend to take it for what it's worth or what it's cost them, which is nothing. If they don't have enough sense to ask for advice to begin with, they rarely have enough sense to appreciate it and to accept it when they do hear it. And so here people have at least gotten to the point where they ask the question, and so they now get the answer from the Lord as to what's really going on here. And so he responds to that. And we're going to come back and talk about that response here in a little bit. But just to mention that third category where sometimes our loss and suffering does us some good as well. Don't know in the case of Ezekiel. You know, that's kind of up to them. You know, how much Ezekiel needed help with his own faith, I don't know. But you'll call the passage in James. James practically begins this way, verse 2. James chapter 1, verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Endurance must have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And so it's just like Brian led us into prayer this morning, knowing that if we want to be pure people, if we want to be more perfect, it may mean difficulties and trials that come our way. We're praying for God to send us difficulties, to chastise us, to train us, to discipline us, to be more holy people. And so we know that can do good for us on occasion. Well, is God being mean-spirited when he puts us through those trials? Is God being inconsistent with his sovereignty, with his nature, with his love, with his power, with his wisdom? No. And if ultimately it is of benefit to us, not financial benefit necessarily, not benefit to our physical health, but our eternal well-being, our salvation, as well as God being glorified, then is that not what we desire? And ultimately, that's the answer here in Ezekiel chapter 24, that Ezekiel's communicating a message of eternal importance to these people. And they need to understand this message and benefit from this message. Now, God's going to be glorified one way or the other, but God would rather be glorified by their obedience and their faithfulness. And ultimately, that's what Ezekiel is pointing to here, that there is an eternal benefit that is coming for which we should not grieve. And so when you return to the message of Ezekiel and you say, okay, his wife has died, God says, now I don't want you carrying on a big deal about that. Why? Well, because that's the way the people are to be. That when the city of Jerusalem's destroyed, when the temple itself is burned to the ground, the people are not to carry on about that. And you say, well, why is that? And there are different answers that people have suggested, that maybe the people are going to be so shell-shocked by the destruction of Jerusalem and the city, the temple of God, that they just are going to be stunned and not able to grieve like normal. Well, that's certainly possible. is God issuing some kind of artificial command? I order you not to grieve like this. And the people will probably listen to that command as well as they've listened to any of his other commandments and do it anyway. Notice the last few verses of this chapter we didn't read, verses 25 through 27. As for you, son of man, will it not be on the day when I take from them their stronghold, the joy of their pride, the desire of their eyes, their heart's delight, their sons and their daughters, that on that day he who escapes will come to you with information for your ears? On that day your mouth will be open to him who escaped. You will speak and be mute no longer. Thus you will be a sign to them, and they will know that I am the Lord. And so there's a benefit in this for Ezekiel in that that restraint that Ezekiel's been under for the whole first half of the book, he can only speak the things that God allows him to speak, that's going to be lifted when news comes of the fall of Jerusalem. And there's this one who escapes, this survivor. And what's interesting is the word is always used not of just of someone who just randomly, haphazardly gets away by chance, but it is the one the Lord has spared. You know, it's the one who has been exempted from God's judgment. And I think ultimately that's what this oracle is pointing to, that the destruction of Jerusalem was not the end of the world. And it wasn't a tragedy in the sense that that was just going to be it. That's the final say on things. That's the end of the book. Last chapter. End of story. Well, that'd be pretty depressing. That Ezekiel understands, the people need to understand, the destruction of Jerusalem was a means to an end. It was God's judgment, but even that judgment was consistent with his love. And it's really a new beginning, and a beginning of something new that is good, which will be greater faithfulness in the Lord, turning to the Lord and relying upon him and getting rid of idolatry. And when you look back historically at the result of the Babylonian captivity, that was what happened. The people overcame their idolatry. Now, they still were fallible people. They still made plenty of mistakes. At the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, you still see them struggling with a lot of things. But they certainly were not the same people they were before. And that's something to rejoice in. And I think that's the point of this. It's not that just naturally they're not going to feel like grieving. But they need to understand this is a good thing that has happened. That the temple had become a place of idolatry. It had become a symbol of the hard-heartedness of the people. It had become an insult to the very nature of God. And so that these things are destroyed, that's a good thing. And we can now rejoice that something better is coming. And I think about this in a lot of different ways. You can make application of this. We think of the Lord's Supper, which represents the crucifixion of Christ and his sacrifice. It's a tragedy in its own right. Do we grieve over the death of Christ? Well, yes, in a sense we do. But does that grief outweigh the joy that comes from the crucifixion of Christ? No, it doesn't. Because we know the death of Christ was not the end, was not the last chapter of the book, is not the end of the story, but was the beginning of something wonderful, which is a right relationship with God. It is the restoration of our fellowship with him. And so we rejoice more than we grieve. And I think that was the point Ezekiel was making to the people of their day. For them, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, was like the crucifixion of Jesus. A means to an end. Yes, something very tragic, but ultimately something we will rejoice more over than we grieve over. And in that, it's a foreshadowing of the destruction of the temple of Jesus' body, the greater temple, the holy temple, the perfect temple, which needed to be destroyed in order that we would have something better, that God is glorified, all mankind is benefited, ourselves included. And so there's this ultimately an eternal benefit, something that is positive, something that is good, something that is right, and something ultimately we don't need to cry over. As tragic as it was at the time, as terrible as some of the things were that unfolded, ultimately it is a cause of celebration. And that's ultimately why we rejoice and celebrate in the Lord's Supper each week. It's not just something that's always somber and just, you know, self-flagellation, you know, slapping ourselves and bemoaning and wailing. No, it is to rejoice in the life that we have in Jesus Christ. And yet, this God that we serve is still the same sovereign God. He is still the same God who is true to His nature yesterday, today, and forever, and always acts for our good and what's best for us. And in that, we need to be prepared for God to demand of us whatever sacrifice, whatever loss, whatever difficulty might come our way in life. Instead of seeing that as a reason to quit believing in God, it is instead a reaffirmation that we ought to be thankful we serve a sovereign God that isn't a democracy where a bunch of idiots get together and vote because they're the majority. Well, that's the way we're going to do things. But that God, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, as the sovereign one, has executed His will and His wisdom. He acts according to His love and always does what is best. And if that means suffering, if it means difficult, if it means testing, if it means death, if it means loss of some kind, of ourselves or another, that doesn't diminish faith in such a God at all. But rather, God is glorified, and we can join with others in glorifying Him. If you will, take your songbooks and turn number 70, Be Thou My Vision. That's a pretty appropriate song to reflect upon who God really is and what He should mean to us. And as always, we reflect upon our relationship with Him in whatever way we might need to do better to recognize the sovereignty of God, to recognize His nature, to recognize His role in our life, and maybe we haven't always responded in faith or as enthusiastically as we should to what God is doing. But if anytime there's anything we can do to help one another, that's what we want to do. And if there's something we can do now to be an encouragement to one another, to study with one another, to render assistance to you in obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, whatever it might be, if you can just let us know, we'll help you in any way that we can while we stand and while we sing the song.